Writing is an act of discovery for Dennis Fennell. He likes trying on different words, phrases, or forms and then rewriting as he dresses and undresses his work. Perhaps that's why his five books of poetry vary greatly from one another, ranging from his more traditional beginnings with the Juniper Prize-winning collection Red Cottage to the experimental erasure work in his fourth book, Pi 8, winner of the 2012 Belle Day Poetry Prize.
Writing is all about selection. And whether it's a taking away or an adding, it's getting at the same thing, and that is trying to, if I say invent the truth, I mean it in the best possible way of discovery, and that is you don't know it until you arrive at it, and you can only arrive through language.
Dennis Fennell talks about his poetry with New Letters magazine editor Robert Stewart and reads from Pi 8 and his 2014 book, Ruins Assembling, winner of the Things to Come Poetry Prize from Shape and Nature Press, today on New Letters On the Air, produced at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm Angela Elam. Dennis Fennell is a longtime resident of Massachusetts, but his 2014 book takes him back to his birthplace of St. Louis, Missouri. Before we launch into that collection, though, we'll hear about Pi 8, the fourth and most unusual of his five books. It's based on short, unused poems and fragments that Fennell collected over the decades, and he trusted a random procedure of numbering the poems, then putting them in a bowl and drawing the numbers to shape the book, before revising with excision and erasure, a process he discusses with New Letters magazine editor Robert Stewart.
There's something of a trend right now of erasure poetry and people taking texts and then blacking out or erasing the words they don't want, selecting out the words they do want, and creating new poems. And it has also a relationship to the found poetry tradition. Were you affected by that tradition of William Burroughs, this cut-up method that he used, and a poet named Tom Phillips who's done some of this? Were you inspired by that tradition?
Well, I would say, given that I had all of these short poems and fragments, I was kind of playing around at the time, and I was aware of these other kinds of processes that other writers had done and also visual artists had done by erasing a script on a page. And I was intrigued by that to see what would happen if editing was left mostly, not solely, but mostly to removal of what had gone before, cutting without pasting. And I did much of that and realized after a while it created a kind of voice. Once you hear one of these poems that is a little fractured, but there's a kind of energy, and I don't know if I would call it a greater honesty, but there is a kind of angular honesty about those things. It's not too polished.
I wonder if we could hear one of these poems.
Sure, I'd be glad to. It's an homage to St. Louis and also a family poem that has to do with visiting my father in St. Louis in old age and returning in summer. And those who've been to St. Louis in summer know how overbearing that can be. So the sweat, the haze, the humidity, and the whispering on the sweet side. My father was going deaf. In other words, that side that he could hear best with. Mm. Another thing I did was just use the first line of the poem as the title of the poem. So the first line goes directly into the body of the poem itself. To return, to wake to cicadas again, insect palmists, to open a door, August all over you, having missed you, experience counts, afternoon feature, heat lightning, flushing the haze, an anthropomorphic two, backlit, then goners to words, aging neighbors, yes, brown grass, thank God, Frigidaire. To suck on a screened porch, hidden in sweat, your animal. To whisper sweet on the deaf side.
That was To Return by Dennis Fennell from his book Pi 8. This is New Letters on the Air, and I'm Robert Stewart. There's something kind of playful about it, but you get some other qualities about good poetry by doing that, which is a compression. You kind of remove that overt narrative from the poem, and what's left are the essential words.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a kind of a juxtaposition that goes on that creates the need for the reader in some ways to fill in that almost instantaneously, that gap between them, because there aren't those things that join the transitions.
So this was originally lyrical poetry. It was the poem, but it had more narrative in it. It had more, maybe some more lyricism in it. And what you did was just begin to work on it to get it compressed even more.
Right. Mm-hmm. And if you can see it on the page helps you, I hope, to hear the poem. I don't know if I can explain that properly.
You know, I like that because I respect the page. A lot of people have been talking a lot about how poetry needs to be oral and it needs to be spoken and all that sort of thing. You can get a different kind of experience by seeing it on the page.
Mm-hmm. And it kind of guides you as you're looking at it in the way to read it. Because when you see the poems on the page, they're little blocks of text and there's space and it might be a little bit confusing. But if you give it your own voice and your own life, if you bring yourself to the poem, I think it comes, the page will tell you how to read it.
One of the things I've noticed about your work, you have a particular kind of relationship with narrative. It seems to me that you become less and less satisfied over the years with a traditional narrative in a poem, but yet you never quite let go. I wonder if you could talk about that relationship that you have with narrative.
I don't know if I can. I think it's mostly anecdotal. In the newer book, Ruins Assembling, I mentioned my father, and I have a short poem that is also directed to him. In this poem, for example, not much happens there. It's not the story of a particular series of events. One happened, this happened, and this happened. But it is a kind of accumulation of maybe significant details that indicate the kind of life that that person had and that people have in general.
I like that poem. Yeah. Let's hear that.
Okay. I might preface this by saying Attu is an island in the Aleutians. My father was stationed there during World War II. Attu, 1943. For my father's retinas, then, each tomorrow was one and the same blip on the horizon. He would look up. Tundra was giving in to his GI's uninsulated boots. Boots meant for Burma's hump. Tundra, with each boot step giving up the rotting ghost, would look up, see tomorrow's island. Its name changed daily, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday. Its name always tomorrow, tomorrow. Its silhouette a nose out of water. Tomorrow was drowning. And because the air bequeathing tundra was rotting, he made an alphabet of his freezing foot bones. What he asked could be asked only in consonants, was answered in a Medusa's jellied vowel.
That was Dennis Fennell reading Attu, 1943, from his book Ruins Assembling, on New Letters on the Air.
If I could compare the manner of these two poems and or these two books, the poem I just read from Ruins Assembling is, in lots of ways, very traditionally lyrical. It's singing a song, basically, about my father and thinking about the terrible conditions under which he had to try to live at that point. Now, if that were a poem that I were going to use in Pi 8, I'd go back and really remove a lot of the things that come across as lyrical. There are some sounds, for example, that I'm pretty deliberate with in order to get a kind of sense of moaning and vowel sounds that I probably wouldn't care that much for if I were working on it for a book like Pi 8.
So this is a sensibility that comes and goes, I guess, in your creative process in terms of how much of the connecting elements and the lyrical elements you want to keep or you want to take out?
Well, it might even just be a kind of laziness on my part. I already have a lot of these things written, and I'm just too lazy to finish them up. It might be that.
Strip them down instead of finishing them up.
Yes, as a great teacher of mine used to say, Madeline DeFries, a poet from the Northwest, strip it down, save it for parts. And that's kind of what I've done over the years. I've got lots of parts sitting around in the warehouse, and let's see if I can do something with them.
Do you have a sense of what it is that compels you to turn to the poem as opposed to anything else?
There was a recognition that there was not a final answer, but a way to find value and meaning in a life through language. And I think that is an abiding sense that I have. And through language that is deeply shaped and formed through poetry, until you start using language to give it some kind of meaning and shape. That's probably where I have the greatest sense of its connection to my life.
You mentioned your father earlier, and it made me wonder if you could tell the listeners a little bit about the community you grew up in, the kind of world it was.
Well, it was a working-class world. I was born just after World War II. Lived in houses that were built in the late 40s and grew up in a neighborhood that was lots of kids, lots of playing on a dead-end street. My father ran a gas station for 20 years. My mom worked at various jobs, so it was a working family. I went to a Catholic school, so there's some Catholic things coming up in poems. I think I do have a poem about going back to the neighborhood from the new book. It's called Mouth of Truths. The title's from that large stone face in Rome, and the legend has it that if you put your hand into the mouth of this stone, it can tell if you're lying, because if you're lying, it will close on you. I've also heard that insects live inside that mouth and will bite you, so maybe that's where the legend began. So this is Mouth of Truths, and it's about going back to my old neighborhood. When I went back to childhood, I rode in the Suzuki down the street, narrowed by my greater self, past tinier post-war capes, now closer, neighbor shadowing neighbor. I resumed my nodding acquaintance with the ghosts of fellow childhood children. My niece chauffeured the Suzuki sidekick, slowing in front of 3241 Rex Avenue. "That's it," my sister in the front seat growled between breaths, hooked to her oxygen. "That's it." With no front door to knock at, no screen door to keep house flies out and let the breeze come into it, just a dark opening into it. I told my 47-year-old baby niece to go slow, so I could see the new neighbor mowing tall grass, mowing Sharon, whose face I mocked for her pimples, whose perfect Sharon face nods at the front of her head. So I could see the other kids recollecting. Mariko's smiling, his gyroscope balanced on a string, Butch's big sister Diane teaching us chess with winter's pawns, the schmuck girls undressing nightly in silhouette behind their curtain, nameless black boy waiting in the honeysuckle fort to play cowboys and Indians, the hemophiliac Ricky and his beautiful sister, both pale as sand, David of the overactive tear ducts, in our stay of execution. Into the dark opening, into it, our doorless doorway, our neighborhood's mouth of truths, we put our hands, saying, memory gives eternity the mercy stroke. So we may leave Rex Avenue in the Suzuki, the heads of childhood rising soap bubbles, our hands still attached at our wrists.
Dennis Fennell reading his poem, Mouth of Truths, from Ruins Assembling, his 2014 edition of poetry. This is New Letters on the Air, and I'm Robert Stewart. I'm also from St. Louis, so it seems to me in many ways that that culture of that city has a particular hold on people who grew up there.
Of course, it's connected up with the people, you know, your family, the neighborhood, the friends you made. And if you leave, you can't leave all of that behind, of course. You can't block all of that out. Even if you've lived apart from it for a long time, as it says in the poem, memory gives eternity the mercy stroke. So that memory kills eternity in a way because it makes it very specific. You know it's in the past, but it also makes it possible for you to pay respect to the kind of lives that people led at that point and to honor them. I think that's what I try to do with it. And of course, there's great loss involved as well. People age, get older, pass on, and I think that's a part of what goes on with some of the poems in this book, Ruins Assembling. I think thus the title, mm-hmm. partly about the ruins of the past and how we can reassemble it in a way to make some sense of it.
Yeah. You have another poem that sort of does the same thing, The Stork. Maybe we could hear that one too.
Sure. Since you are from St. Louis, I don't know if you went to the Stork Inn. It's the name of the place where these events took place.
I don't recall ever being there.
It's Southside. The Stork. Visiting friends in my birth city, actually, an acquired taste. But M.A.'s been there. She let centripetal force shove her from my car as we circled a cul-de-sac called Vale Court. She was a wise moon. Now these two friends illustrate how well our cities turned out. It is as if the city is my twin. I want it to do well and not be in rehab. It is me. So the West End is now littered with sidewalk cafes in lieu of street people. C'est moi. Thus I have sidewalk cafes and am free of lice. Cafes with names like Coco's, The Good Egg, Isis. And many things shine and want to dazzle me. The metallic rim of that cafe table, for example, and that young woman's incisors. They both blind. And an immaculate spittoon planted with real geraniums. One measure of success is the degree of disregard the successful one can imply. Remember, the city is me. Thus, the height of success is ignorance. I ignore myself. It makes me shine in cafe names, in brass containers for spit, disfigured with red blossoms. We order strawberry crepes and cafe au lait. We're done. We leave a 50% tip. Waitress Bridget will no doubt remember us aloof and dazzling until a bigger tipper comes. An eternal flame demands the biggest gratuity. Where is the statue of our city's saint? Is it living outside memory words? There it is, over there atop Art Hill. Place name, not persons, in Forest Park. The bronze St. Louis rides a strutting bronze horse, its big ears pointed like those on a fixed Doberman. Saint and horse do not shine. Saint and horse oxidized by the century. The saint holds his sword high by the blade. Blade and quillions make a cross. Is he on crusade? Louis, Louis. We are cruising my birth city. We are lost between the Mississippi and the night. Where shines the city's soul? Is it in the neon Peabody coal reflection inverted on the Mississippi? Is it in street lamps fanning out in sulfurous rays from the old cathedral? Is it from the 630-foot stainless Omega on the riverbank? We're lost in my birth city. What about the neighborhood bar called the Stork, wedged like a carrot into text, into these old brick apartments? We enter its apex. We are lost. Thus ignorant, we sniff the acrimony of success. Soon we may gleam. Here in the Stork, a toddler crawls on the floor. Mommy wears a red dress, plays video poker. Perchance she won baby here. Perchance we shall win a family of our own. Perchance the shy barman is my brother, washed out of the turret with a hose. He shall be christened Glenn. He lives in the wedge in an apartment above the bar. He rises there now to bring M.A. celery and tomato juice. Bottoms up. I do this still in memory. Bottoms up. The throne of mirrored bottles around Glen shone like the sun, which shed its rays far and wide. We exit the Stork, its apex. I do this in memory still. I re-enter the kingdom of my birth.
You're listening to the poet Dennis Fennell reading a poem called The Stork from Ruins Assembling, here on New Letters on the Air. The imagery that you have in your poems referring to the St. Louis Arch as the stainless steel Omega, drawing those kind of connections and that allusion to Louis Louis and the entire cultural era of that particular time, making those connections is what makes the poems really exciting.
Well, in writing the poem, that's what makes it exciting to write, too. Sometimes it's a lot of time and a lot of sheer work, but a lot of it is just allowing yourself to make these connections. For example, in looking at the arch, I use an actual omega, not the word omega, in the poem. So you have this visual arch right there in the poem. That's fun. That's got to be enjoyable to do, you know?
You know, the other thing I'm thinking of, too, as you were reading that, is really the great number of poems written by other poets about their birth cities and their home cities. Obviously, you have Jack Gilbert's Pittsburgh, and you have Major Jackson's Philadelphia. Some of the great poems in our culture are about people's connections and deep love for the cities where they're from. And it's like the city is part of them. It really is a touching and moving thing to think about.
Right. We're so connected to those places where we walk and we sit down and we eat and work and play that perhaps it's only in standing back from the place and taking the time to view it that we can really understand what it means. And sometimes what it means is, if you're honest with yourself, a love-hate kind of thing going on there. St. Louis is a gritty place, and it always was a gritty place. But sometimes it was also a beautiful place. And sometimes it was beautiful because it was gritty. I think most people feel that way about wherever they live, if they've had a wide enough range of experience to go there. By the way, the Stork is a National Historic Site. Now it's an architectural office. And it's a wonderful wedge-shaped building in South St. Louis. I've been thinking about sending them a copy of this poem.
Yeah, they'll probably put it in bronze and mount it on the wall somewhere.
I don't know about that. Come on now, it's St. Louis.
Well, one other poem that you have that I must get you to read is a poem that takes place maybe on the outskirts of St. Louis in the county, which is a poem of yours called Silent Running.
Silent Running, the title, it's a term that was used, I believe, in submarine warfare. Submarines would dive and then turn off all their engines so they couldn't be noticed by those ships trying to bomb them or something. But what friends and I would do late at night was go on these runs in an old car that I used to have, which was a Studebaker, and we would run in the dark with the engine off, and it became a little bit of a tradition for all of us to do it. And we would pack the car with all of our friends and even some on the roof and hood,
and nobody died.
Which is somehow miraculous in all of that.
It is miraculous, isn't it? Silent running. 40 years ago, I drove a yellow Studebaker, a friend on my hood. One or two more clung to the roof, and inside, five or six of us singing, "Oh, roll your leg over." Two plumes of drying barf streaked away like painted flames from the rear side windows. A little print of Bruegel's peasant wedding hung from the clothes hook in back to class up the act. More than once, Sundays, 2 a.m., we would drive like this down the hill of Charbonnier Road until just the right speed, and then I'd cut the flathead engine, push in the clutch, and we'd coast powerless downhill in silence. And if in moonlight, I'd cut the headlights, and we'd go in near darkness, all of us quieted, until a driver coming toward us would get within range. Then I'd pull the headlights on and tweak the ignition key, the engine backfiring like a 12-gauge, just as our fellow traveler passed by. Today, I am that fellow traveler, jack-lit by a beast, half young man, half Studebaker. I am a flathead six-cylinder engine firing its coup de grace, headlights giving myself the third degree. The windows of the self rolled down. I am a blue eye in the ditch of Charbonnier Road. I am a pink ear. And 2 a.m. blows by. And a minute later, 2 a.m. blows by, and a minute later, 2 a.m. blows by. So clearly, I live now and then in Bruegel's peasant bride, who herself keeps her eyes closed, clasped hands resting in her lap, the quiet, everlasting being magnetizing the babble of her own wedding. And my friends, Jim lies spread eagle, gripping the chrome-winged hood ornament. Bob and I reach out our windows, hold him by his ankles, triangulating him. Mike and Ron lie on the roof, grab on to the rain gutters, friends in back reaching out to hold them by their legs. All of us coast downhill towards the Missouri River bottomlands, each of us holding on to another. Ignorant, we would live forever, true, but in moonlight at most, and without one word, save the wind's admonitions.
Silent Running, a poem by Dennis Fennell, first published in New Letters magazine and now part of his 2014 book, Ruins Assembling, winner of the Things to Come Poetry Prize from Shape and Nature Press. He also discussed his previous collection, Pi 8, that won the Belle Day Poetry Prize. Read three new poems by Dennis Fennell in the summer 2016 issue of New Letters magazine, edited by Robert Stewart, today's interviewer. To subscribe, go to newletters.org. There you can also find archive recordings that feature readings from even earlier books by Dennis Fennell. New Letters on the Air is a production of New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, with partial support from the Missouri Arts Council, a state agency. Today's show was produced with Jamie Walsh, Blair Ginsburg, Megan Fulkin, Stephanie Hughes, and Nick Shea. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.